just in the context of the visit to Caesarea Philippi. But what's interesting about Luke chapter 9 is that it tells us that about 8 days after Jesus makes the big statement, he takes a couple of his disciples to the high mountain, and we know the transfiguration story. He ascends, and again, this is like the final warning for the demonic realm. But the last is this really weird festival, the mini festival, the Feralia. And this is when the most malevolent and wicked of these underworld spirits was to be placated by the worship. Now, isn't it interesting that if I'm right, while that's happening in Caesarea Philippi, Jesus is going up at the same time on Mount Hermon and the transfiguration is taking place?
Hey everyone in the Blurryverse. This week we've got Dr. Judd Burton back on the show. Judd's been on the show many times. It's great to hear his voice again. He's healing up and sounding better than ever. If you want to support this podcast, blurrycreatures.com/members. We're releasing a lot of bonus episodes lately, so you can get access to those. We have a chat next Thursday night, the 27th, 7 p.m. And then we're going to do a movie for gold members afterwards. So join up, join the team, get blurry with us. Thanks for all the messages. Got a lot of stories lately from you guys that is going to turn into potential bonus episodes. So keep an eye out for those. And let's get Dr. Judd on this one.
The history of our earth is so different from what we can imagine.
Enjoy the journey. The Smithsonian, and if they found out about a large skeleton somewhere, was to go get it.
I'm going to assume at least one person is right, because if one person's right, it busts the paradigm.
It all goes back to the fallen cherub. And the problem with the modern day church, they have a very truncated view of the supernatural.
This backdrop that's just pregnant with all kinds of meaning associated with this Mount Hermon event.
Welcome to Blurry Creatures.
And this guy defects from the kingdom. That's a big deal.
Welcome back to the podcast. Dr. Judd Burton, otherwise known as DJB. Judd, I think people want a song, and you said you were going to sing.
We're going to start with a song. I feel like we need to build this to a crescendo, and then, no, you know, and then
just
like,
go right no, in. And
start. This is an easy way to break into it.
Just as long as it's not, let's start with a crescendo and then continue throughout
yes,
the rest
well,
of
might
the
as well. Let's get to a fever yeah, pitch here.
You don't want to decrescendo. Well, I figured since we were going to talk about Peter a little bit tonight, 16 tons might be appropriate.
Mm, very much so.
You know, poor man's made out of muscle. How does it start? It's a, well, some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones, a mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Let's go. Tennessee Ernie Ford. Let's go.
Welcome back.
What a pull.
Welcome back to Blurry Creatures. There it is, guys. You don't get that. You don't get that anywhere.
Man, that is. Judd, you know what I love is that you match the song it's shadows of what's to come. And it's, dude, you pull a Tennessee Ernie Ford song. I mean, and because there's one line about St. Peter, and it is, gosh, you know, you could have gone Peter, Paul, and Mary. You could have gone Peter Cetera. But, you know, right. I like where you went with this.
Peter Gabriel.
Peter Gabriel.
Peter Gabriel. Yeah. Yeah. That would have been a real sledgehammer.
You know what? You know, this is just like Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
You did not choose poorly. You chose wisely.
Here's a little bit of trivia before we get deep into it. Actually, Tennessee Ernie Ford didn't write that song. He popularized it. It was Merle Travis that actually wrote that.
Good old Merle Travis.
Judd, you know, we had so many great episodes with you, and it's been a long time. And we were talking, you were texting, just to give our listeners a little what's to come. You're talking about sacred geography and sacred time revolving around Peneus.
I love that we're going here, Judd, because I feel like a lot of our episodes have, you know, you've written extensively about Peneus, and we've talked about the importance of Peneus, Mount Hermon, the cult associated with Peneus, and then of course the reasoning and specificness for Jesus going there, right? Because we've talked about this, I think, on one of our previous episodes about how it was so far out of the way. Like, it wasn't like it was just like, hey guys, let's saddle up the camels and we're going to Galilee. But it was an intentionality of heading to Peneus, which is now Caesarea Philippi at the base of Ground Zero. Although, Nate, you did say Ground Zero for blurriness was in Peru, and I knew that wasn't quite correct, maybe for Cyclopean architecture.
I meant more like Ground Zero in terms of like what's left over.
Correct.
Like, there's not a whole lot left over in a lot of these sites, but Peru somehow manages to have some of the best preserved blurry stuff. So that's kind of what I meant.
And just so you know, Judd, Nate climbed a mountain in jeans and low top Air Force Ones because he wanted to make a point.
That's right.
Dare I ask what the point was?
There was no point. There was a point to make it harder than it actually was, which is extremely hard. But we digress.
The point was, is I'm on brand. Marty McFly, you 80s yeah. podcast. You got to take your Nikes and your jeans, and you got to get up that hill. I didn't have a vest on, but I was close.
But you had your Calvin Klein underwear.
I did, yeah.
Your name is now amongst the greats like Sir Edmund Hillary. So.
That's correct, yes. And Hiram Bingham. By the way, fourth great grandfather of mine. So
hey,
good stuff.
We're all about the trivia tonight.
We are. But Judd, let's get into this. It's great to have you back again. I know that you. I believe I could be wrong, right? Did you do your PhD studies on Peneus? Correct? Is that?
Yeah, I have my dissertation on Peneus.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So, of course, this is right in your wheelhouse, Judd. And even now, years after. After being bestowed with the good doctorate, you're still learning new things about this space, or maybe discovering new things about this space. This is a very important space, right? Because you might say this backdrop is pregnant with meaning. Yeah, one might say.
Could say that. I would say so, and I have said so.
Yes. So our listeners, we talk a lot about Mount Hermon. We've talked a lot about it extensively with just about everybody on the show. And at the base of it is this place. And we're going to get into it today, but I think, Judd, you bring, just like you brought some interesting understandings of, you know, you look at things from a different point of view. We talked to you a lot about the ancient giants. That was our first episode we did with you. And then we talked about some of the wording around the Rephaim and the words Rapha and Ra. And we talked about how that could be connected to these Nephilim kings. Then we talked about the tombs of the god kings. Mm-hmm. On an episode, we've talked about vampires and werewolves and a couple episodes, but we seem to be kind of hovering around Mount Hermon a lot on our show. So, Judd, give it to us. What do you know about this place that we don't know?
Well, again, your audience, who I love and adore, you know, they're no strangers to this topic, Mount Hermon, the Genesis 6 event, and even to a large extent, you know, the sort of localized history of Peneus. So I don't want to retread old tires, but by way of review, and I want to dwell more on the sacred time rather than sacred geography, because so much of that has been the conversation, you know, up this point, and it's important. It needs to be understood. And so I'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll launch into some of the new findings that I've had. It's no secret, either from the archaeological or historical record, that this region is important. The beliefs of the ancient Hebrews, and even once the area was Hellenized, a lot of the beliefs that they brought with them dovetailed with what was going on in the region to begin with. And so the role that the Mount Hermon region has played, not only in the history of the Levant, but even other places like Mesopotamia, is a long established tradition in multiple, you know, sets of literature. So in all the work that I've done on this, it occurred to me that, you know, the best that we could really kind of do at one point was to kind of estimate where, not where, but when Jesus and his disciples were at Caesarea Philippi, this account that's in Matthew chapter 16 and Mark chapter 8, and is sort of paralleled in Luke chapter 9 in places, primarily in the Matthew and Mark text. Most of what I had read and researched was that Jesus and his disciples were at Caesarea Philippi sometime in the winter before his death. And I always thought, okay, that's a good place to start with. But, you know, something told me that there was more there, you know, that there were more layers to the onion. And it seemed like that there could possibly be markers somewhere. And again, having looked at these passages hundreds of times, I was looking to see if there was something that was sort of hiding in plain sight. And so I started to focus more on what clues Luke chapter 9 could possibly give. But before we jump into that, I'll preface it by saying that the first, you know, sort of initial stages of this hypothesizing, we know kind of the nuts and bolts of what Jesus is doing when he's at Caesarea Philippi. And we know that Jesus' pacing and timing and selection occasions to give homilies and perform miracles and stuff like that, we know that there's generally something there. In other words, he's not randomly doing things. You know, there are these multiple levels of teaching that Jesus is always engaged in. So keeping that in mind, I wondered if there's anything in the Greco-Roman context of which, you know, Caesarea Philippi was a thoroughly Hellenized city by that time. It had not just the short lifetime of the city, but the region, the Paneion, was a kind of melting pot of Hellenism, you know, for a couple of centuries by the time Jesus and the disciples lived there. So it had time to accumulate and thoroughly Hellenize the local Etrurian population.
The original Hell Valley.
Well, if you want to call it that, I suppose.
Jeez.
Go on. You started with a Back to the Future joke. Come on.
What a reach.
I can see it now. The little domiciles in Levittown style houses that dotted the floor of the valley at the time, or their rough equivalent.
The old Twin Pines to the old Lone Pine, right?
Yeah. Wouldn't be pines. It would be cedars, right?
Cedars, you know, correct. Yeah.
Hey, we're just going to use Back to the Future jokes the rest of the episode, Jed. So just get used to it. The episode.
That's going to keep me on my toes. So the first thing that really jumps out at me in reconsidering, you know, the timing of Jesus's arrival is, well, if his arrival and presence there and what he says and what he does there is firing a shot over the bow of the enemy, then it makes sense that the timing, the when, would also have the same kind of logic to it. The Lupercalia, that's still it's late winter, but it's still in the winter. And the Lupercalia takes place on February the 15th, and this is the festival to Pan. So I thought that would stay in line with the reasoning of the general reasoning of why Jesus was there in the first place. It was the same kind of logic. It was a slight, in this case, Pan, Azaga, Azazel, whatever name, you know, wanted to put on that. That would be a real slap in the face. You know, Jesus establishing the church, saying all the things that he did, the homily that ensues at Caesarea Philippi, Petrine confession, the establishment of the church, the gates of hell will not withstand against it. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of timing sense for the Lupercalia Festival.
What is this festival?
Well, the Lupercalia Festival is in honor of the god Pan.
What did they do?
Well, the overarching idea was that, there were rituals that were done to keep their flock safe, from predators like wolves. And even one of the things that they were keeping their flock safe from, one of the beliefs they had is that they were doing these protective rites to keep werewolf-like creatures away as well as wolves.
Wow.
Very blurry.
But in terms of rituals, Pan is associated with fertility and sexuality, and so a lot of the rites are reflective of those kinds of ideas. One of them, the big one, very strange, and I've talked about this before, but they're the young maidens, women of childbearing age, would all line up on the thoroughfare, the Carta Maximus, as it were, and they would bare their thighs, and a group of young men dressed in goat skins called the Lupercai would come by with these leather tongs and slap them on the leg. And this was supposed to ensure fertility, not only for the flocks, but also for people too.
Hmm.
And I still think that that's the target day when all of this is taking place.
What day was that again?
That was February the 15th.
Okay.
That's 2 days after the Ides of February. You've heard of the Ides of March from Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes the Ides falls on the 13th of a month, and February on the Roman calendar is one of them. So, yeah, it made perfect sense to me that given the pacing and timing of the rest of what's going on at Caesarea Philippi, that the logical timing for when Jesus makes all of these crucial Caesarea Philippi statements be on the Lupercalia.
So it's kind of like from modern day Americans, most of our audience is America. It's like Jesus rolling into New Orleans on Mardi Gras kind of thing.
Yeah, something very similar. Yeah, exactly. And interestingly enough, Mardi Gras takes place in February. It's descended from the old Carnival festival in medieval Europe, which is basically a public pornographic display of carnality. It's the same kind of thing that's going on. And I suspect that a lot of people like to argue that it's Valentine's Day that preserved the Lupercalia, but I think the more logical argument is that it's the Carnival that preserves some of the elements of the Lupercalia.
Didn't even realize that word Carnival.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Judge is dropping the bombs on us.
And they also were sacrificing goats, which is, of course, an effigy of Pan, right? And also dogs, which is sad, makes me hate them.
Mm-hmm.
But no French bulldogs were taken out.
Of course not, man. You wouldn't do that. They were revered. They've always been revered. no, but I think sometimes, and that's what I love about what we do on the show, especially when we do in episodes like this, Judd, is there's all these... You could say backdrop just because, right? But it really is. There's this backdrop to the scripture, and I think it's so important because we read the words, and I have I brought Luke 9 up just to take a look as you're speaking, because I'm curious on where this is going, and the words are amazing, right? And but I think oftentimes we get a very flat view of the gospel and even of the biblical text. This is what we do on the show, Nate. We talk about sort of providing context and also backdrop, tapestry, whatever you want to call it around it, but like to understand this, right? To understand, and I think we've walked through this with you, Judd, and understanding, what about Peneus is important? And you talked about the shot across the bow, and that's something we talked about in our episode. But I think adding this to it and understanding that more than likely Jesus showed up at this time, and I think all of us can put, Nate, I think it was kind of brilliant, the Mardi Gras analogy and the timing, can put that in. And so you start to have this idea of maybe what more it looked like when Jesus showed up, and it just seems all that much more intentional. And I'm really excited to hear where this goes, because I think these things are so important to understand. Like, one of the things that I really liked, Nate, when we talked to Joel Matamale about territorial spirits, he was talking about cosmic geography. And I like that term, and it kind of comes to mind, the idea that like the physical geography also had very much cosmic geographical implications. And right. And I think that when we start to think that way about the scripture and about the stories in the scripture and about the actions and the intentionality of Jesus and being the Messiah and the Son of God, and
and understanding the things he was doing were very intentional, that I think we'd be remiss, and that's what I love about what we're doing right now in this space, is understanding cosmically why it's so important. And so I just want to call that out and say, this is why it's important, is that it doesn't make it more important, but I think it provides context. And this is, I think, Nate, on a macro level, what we try to do here, right, is to provide context and answers to things about why. Like, why is this happening? And why people experiencing things they do, and also why is Jesus doing the things that he did, and why and things in the Bible happen the way they happened. Mm-hmm. And so it's a long-winded to say, I love this, Jeb, because I think this provides such an amazing backdrop. I can't make this.
You can't, you can't, you can't.
I can't, I even say, you know, but it is pregnant just with at it, so Jeb. Much meaning. It is.
To make another doc joke, guys, Dr. Emmett Brown. It's not where the hell are they. The more appropriate question is, when the hell are they?
It's both. I mean, we're sort of asking, when the hell are they tonight? But yeah, they're both important questions. And to your point, Luke, you know, we do get kind of just a superficial, flat reading if we're just, you know, not that the Holy Spirit can't talk to you, you know, just from a reading of scripture, but you have to, it's some work to get the proper context, you know, even as a lay Bible student, you know, it demands some work to understand the historical and cultural context.
I would say, Judd, the thing that I think we forget sometimes, maybe at least I do, is that as 21st century Westerners, like if you were living the time of Jesus, you would have completely understood this. Mm-hmm. This makes sense. But I think sometimes we get so far disconnected. It doesn't, I want to reiterate this. This is not hidden knowledge or anything like that. It literally is just historical context and cultural context. You say you're a biblical anthropologist. So this is the cultural anthropology of what is happening. And it would have been just like Gen 6 would have made so much sense to people at the time. And we live in Gen 6 a lot. It would have made so much sense to people then because they understood the context of that. That's why it's four verses. And we, you know, a lot of people these days get their minds blown about what actually happened. But this would have been like requisite knowledge. And it would have been, of course, to people at the time. And I think, you know, post-Enlightenment, academic era, and so far separated by time, these things are so important to understand. And I'm gonna stop hammering that home, but I do think.
No, I mean you're right. You're right. They really are, and we have so many tools available to us now that, you know, think about biblical scholars 100, 200, 300 years ago.
Yeah,
couldn't have dreamed they would have at their hands. So there's so many things that people can use to avail themselves of that, and I always encourage people to do that. You know, people can. I have students, you know, that I'm opening that door, you know, for them. So it is tricky. And, you know, as you were talking, it occurred to me that understanding the audience is so crucial in the context equation. And that's where biblical critics sort of get bogged down in quagmires, intellectual quagmires, because, you know, they'll throw stuff out like the prophets or Jesus or fill in the blank, you know, some author of one of the biblical books doesn't talk about this. Well, if it's a ensconced part of the culture, which many times, more often than not, it is, it was implicit. The audience already knew there was no reason for the speaker to go at great length. And so a lot of those criticisms, in my estimation, really fall short scholastically.
No, it'd be like us talking haphazardly about something we saw online and then having to espouse what the internet is. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is interesting, is that because we are separated, this is the context that is, I think, is enlightening in understanding, as you would say, the sacred timing, and then also the sacred geography of what's happening. And I would say this for me, Nate, like I did coming into this show 3 years ago, I didn't understand, you know, the significance of Caesarea Philippi and Peneus and Jesus even going there. I mean, of course, you always get the explanation that, like, oh, on this rock is about Peter. And even if you just think about the physical geography, you don't ever really think about the fact that, like, man, Jesus went out of his way to take everybody there. That doesn't even blip the radar for a lot of people, though, on a basic level, because they're not familiar with the actual topography and physical geography of Israel and Syria and these places that you don't know. And so you're like, of course, yeah, he went there. You know, I don't know where Nazareth or Galilee or...
Even understand ancient pagan worship. You don't understand what they were building, why they were building it. You don't have any frame of reference to... It's like you know, Judd, you're trying to put a little bit of color in a black and white text, right? You're trying to say, you know, and we've done that a lot on our show. And what we've found a lot when we've gone to these, we just went to Peru and we see some of these ancient places, is how forgetful the human species is. I mean, you have the natives, the true natives, saying, we didn't build this stuff. But then you have the modern day people saying, oh yeah, we built it. And just a couple hundred years and everyone forgets. And you can imagine. Yeah.
Well, for me, as a historian, the importance of what you're talking about really didn't come from any historians that I was reading in graduate school, but there was an anthropologist named Clifford Geertz, and his big tome was something called Thick Description, in which he outlined this, you know, you have to be as nuanced as you possibly can in your description of a culture, building a culture narrative, you know, whether you're an archaeologist, a historian, or anthropologist. And it really drove that point home, knowing that looking back, you know, we're still only dealing with fragmentary evidence, but you can still accumulate as much of that as you possibly can to make the most cohesive picture. In this case, to build the more colorized, as you put it, the more colorized version of the culture, indeed the cultures, plural, that you're working with here in terms of audience and direction.
Mm. So here's a dumb question. So I imagine it's a crowded time. There's basically a big event going on. Jesus rolls in and he's preaching, and you're thinking other people are listening to this. He's got a crowd around him. Like, what does it matter if there's a lot of people there or not? What do you think?
Well, it matters because there would have been people within earshot of what Jesus, even if Jesus was just talking to his disciples, got a lot of people in the city, people coming in from other small villages and towns who were Hellenized, who would have been taking part in this. You would had local Jewish population. So, you know, they would have probably tried and steer clear just in terms of staying ritually pure away from this. But there might have been Jews, you know, walking through who heard, you know, who would have heard Jesus as well. So it's important to understand that in terms of audience, you know, or potential audience would have been there. Certainly there would have been more people than were in Jesus's group of disciples who would have been within earshot and heard the things that he said. Not only heard, but would have been familiar with, let's say they were one of the local Hellenized Etrurians. They would have been familiar with not just the pagan stuff that was going on in town at the time, but they would have been familiar with the local Jewish traditions as well about Mount Hermon.
Mm. But he goes all the way there. And I think sometimes Christians, you know, we have such a hard time. We have such a this, you know, Jesus kind of tiptoes around things. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, he shows up to Burning Man Festival.
Mm-hmm. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
It's just so why Lupercalia? What do you think is so specific about this timing? Well, I mean, obviously it was a...
Again, it's Pan, it's been well demonstrated. It's common knowledge that Pan is a god that's being revered at the Lupercalia. Because you have this shrine to Pan there, from which the place takes its name, the region takes its name, it makes sense that Jesus is, it's not just the Hellenic facade or face that Pan has, but this is a shot, I suspect, at Azazel and the, by extension, the Sherim, the satyrs in ancient Hebrew lore. So keeping that in mind, it brings out, again, part of that nuance that I was talking about. And it will certainly become clearer as we sort of pivot into the next discovery that I made about what I believe is the case to be made for the more exact timing and pacing of what Jesus is doing at Caesarea Philippi.
Do you think also that Jesus is trying to get into the disciples' heads, sort of what they're warring against? So he goes there and he talks to them specifically. I don't think the disciples really got it till after the fact. But you think they're putting together all these places that he's going and everything he's saying, and it's like if they don't go there, it doesn't really hit them. I think like Luke and I just went to Peru and we see this stuff. It's just so much more amazing when you're standing there looking at it and you're like, I could talk about this all day long, but here I am in front of it. It's kind of incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. They certainly would have been working this stuff out, you know, in their head, notwithstanding that you've got some knuckleheads amongst the disciples. Let's just go ahead and and use the scholastic term for it. There were some knuckleheads amongst the disciples, but yeah, they would have been trying to, you know, why did the master take us here? You know what? We're in the Greco-Roman pagan capital of the region. You know, what in the world is, and certainly they would have been familiar with the Mount Hermon stuff. And so some of them probably did piece it together, but it was, like you say, it was a slow process. It was a slow burn. You know, Thomas Jefferson once said that you never know how a place has affected you until you've left it. Mm-hmm. And there's probably some truth to that at play in the Caesarea Philippi episode. And certainly what I believe is the timing and pacing hereafter has a lot to do with giving the disciples something else to think about in terms of the significance of the visit itself.
And do you think that, like, Jesus showing up to these places, even just showing up, has a cosmic effect on the location and maybe the principalities and powers that are there?
Well, I mean, clearly, anytime Jesus shows up and confronts these forces directly, you know, they're fearful for their eternity. You know, they say things like, "Son of Man, have you come to throw us into the pit already?" They were fearing that final judgment, that maybe he had stepped up the timetable or something. And so, yeah, there's a definite quaking, if you will, caused by anytime Jesus is confronting these entities. And of course, when is he not during the course of his ministry?
That's right.
We just don't think about it that way. I don't think we were taught to think about it this way. I don't think.
No.
It didn't matter where he went. It was just like he was doing the same thing wherever he went, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It sounds like more and more, as you understand sort of these ancient spaces and what each place was dealing with, there's a specific miracle or event that goes around or sermon or telling. It's right. Like 4D chess, and you can't think about it just in human terms. You have to think about it in principalities, powers, and other realms, what's happening there too.
Yeah, this doesn't detract from, you know, previous generations of biblical scholars, because, you know, heck, there has to be precedent. You know, there were some really big eggheads that have laid this foundation for the rest of us. But we're at such a turning point now, you know, with thinkers like our mutual friend, Dr. Heiser, that the doors of understanding this stuff have been swung so wide open that there is such a counterbalance against it by the enemy, so that you have things like postmodernism and this weird dialectic, you know, that keeps all of us at each other's throats and divided and purely materialistic and naturalistic. And so we certainly live in interesting times in terms of both what's available for us to help us understand this nuance that we're talking about tonight, but also the forces that are continuing to fight against it, just as they did in Jesus' day.
So you think exactly when he rolled into town?
I think I can make a pretty good case for a more exact time frame of when he rolled into town. And I think it begins, I think what he says, you know, the Matthew 16, Mark chapter 8, you know, material, I think that happens around the time, if not on, the Lupercalia. But there's and this is what I've been waiting for. There's something else. There's another festival in the Greco-Roman world that's happening during the Lupercalia. Now, the Lupercalia is just one day. Remember, it's February the 15th. When Jesus and his disciples arrive in Caesarea Philippi, the likelihood, in fact, the probability that this other festival was being celebrated alongside it is extremely high. And this festival was the Parentalia. The Parentalia lasted from February the 13th until, it lasted about 9 days. So it's going to end on, you know, the 21st, 22nd. This was a festival that honored the dead. It was a time when the people in the Greco-Roman world would placate these spirits called the Manes, and or the Parentales. They were the spirits of dead ancestors. To me, that's already interesting, even against the older, you know, Amorite Canaanite context, because there are all of these dolmens, you know, spread throughout the land in the Transjordan. There's Gilgal Rephaim, This is quite literally the land of the Rephaim, the dead kings of the underworld. You know, people will think about Og. Well, Og is emblematic of these dead kings that are analogous to the Rabbah in the Mesopotamian abyss.
Is this kind of like the Dia de los Muertos? Is that the kind of, it's like the original festival?
Well, it's the same kind of thing. You've got some of that happening in the Roman calendar in the fall in too. But it's very similar to Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, because people would actually go to the tombs of their loved ones and would offer meals to these spirits. Mm. They would dine at them. And we certainly know this because there's, at Peneus, there's no shortage of layers of busted up votive pottery that they brought with them, you know, whether they were bringing their, you know, casseroles or whatever they were eating, you know, they brought it in this stuff, and a lot of it just got smashed and churned up into what archaeologists call the Matrix, not the movie Matrix, but this would be broken pottery, debitage, that sort of thing.
The strata.
Strata, that's right. The evidence for it is quite abundant on that end. And so when you consider that there's, you know, there's a Rephaim connection here to what's going on with the honoring of the dead, that's how your Jewish audience is certainly going to see this sort of thing. You know, the Greco-Roman population is going to think, well, these people were our family, and so we need to continue honoring them and indeed communicate with them to keep them, you know, placated and happy in the underworld. So this went on, again, as I said, for about 8 or 9 days. Again, it's hard to miss this connection between the traditions of that are probably prehistoric in the Levant, these traditions of cults of the dead, as it were, and certainly the motif of the dolmen as a grave marker or some sort of altar to, you know, some sort of memoriam to the dead, that is also established.
Is that okay? So a lot of people have posted the photos of this mm-hmm. cave opening, and mm-hmm. some people surmise that there was like a temple built around this cave opening at one point.
Right. Most scholars think that this was the Augustaeum that Herod the Great built. You know, it was kind of pandering to Herod the Great. There's no doubt that there was some sort of structure in front of it at one point in time. This might have been to facilitate the actual worship that went on there, but it was clear that the cave was the actual shrine. But most of the Augustaea and the temples to Augustus that you find remnants for in the Levant were all built on hilltops. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make a lot of sense that that was the Augustaeum in front of it. And I have suggested that more survey needs to be done on the cliff, on top of the cliff above the cave, or higher points in the area to look for this Augustaeum. But so there, it's clear that there was some sort of, you know, it might have been a temple, it might not have been. Hmm. If you read the literature, again, most scholars are going to say, oh, yeah, well, that's the Augustaeum. But it's not on the high point, really, of the city. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if that was the case. But it is part of the larger, what's known as the Temenos, where all the other temples and niches would have been.
But this cave, right, that's what Jesus is looking at when he says, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it?
I think so. When he's using imagery like the gates of hell, immediately that certainly would have rang true with his disciples, but it would have, you know, any of the pagans in earshot would have understood this too, because pagans viewed not just caves, but caves that were associated with waterways like you have at Peneus. They associated these with entrances to the underworld. And so there's that imagery as well, you know, against, you know, the timing of this Parentalia festival, when I believe that Jesus and his disciples are here.
So Judd, pull this thread for us now. So we've got Lupercalia on the 15th of February. We have Parentalia, which is the 13th to the 21st of February, which is the veneration of the dead. I wanted to make mm-hmm. a joke about pouring out for the homies, but it does remind me of, you know, of what Nate was saying, like, especially in Haiti, where they do go and they do this, they sit at the graves and they eat and they pour wine. And this festival was much of the same. It was the veneration of the dead. And then if you've listened to the show, listeners, we did an episode with Derek Gilbert about the Valley of the Shadow of Death, which mm-hmm. is in Bashan, and there are about 10,000 dolmens. So you would be familiar with this vernacular, that these are what Jed's talking about. So if we have these two things going on, Jed, pull this thread for us. Why does Lupercalia fall in the middle of Parentalia and these two festivals coinciding with the arrival, or at least what you would surmise as, or what you believe is the arrival of Jesus and his disciples to this, you know, really famous event at Peneus? Why do you believe these things coincided for such cosmic importance to this event?
Because it's not just the superficial element that we're dealing with here. It's in this case the infernal geography, sacred geography, but it's the infernal geography here of these cults of the dead, these familial cults that are celebrated not only just during the Parentalia, but there were cults of the dead in the Levant too. And as you pointed out, and Derek and I are in agreement on this. In fact, Doug Van Dorn and I are working on a book where we cover a lot of this material too. And so, yeah, you've got, you know, in the ancient times, the Hula Valley, which is just to the south of this, and I'm sure Derek referenced, was this great festering swamp. It was malarial. In fact, that's why the Israelis drained it, you know, because it was a malarial swamp. And you had all these archaic, you know, even in Jesus' day, you know, these archaic monuments to the dead all throughout the region, throughout the Hula, going up towards Bani Espanaeus. So this would also be something that would not be lost on the audience or audiences that Jesus is talking to at Caesarea Philippi while all this is going on, while he's saying all this amidst the Parentalia, the Lupercalia directed at, again, Pan, Azazel. But the Parentalia context, Jesus is talking about these ousted Rephaim and by extension, their forebears, the Watchers, who were now these abysmal god kings of the underworld that so many of the regional religions record in their literature as revering. So that's the larger nuance at work here, but there's more.
Give it to us.
Like I said, I looked at what Luke chapter 9 could tell us about more about the Parentalia, possibly about this timing. Not necessarily, it doesn't reference the Parentalia. But there are some interesting pacing issues here in Luke chapter 9. And one has to do with clearly that Jesus and his disciples parked it at Caesarea Philippi for a while. They're there ministering, they're teaching. It's a prime time to talk about the good news to the pagans or even the Jews in the region. We certainly have the record of Jesus, you know, healing people. He had just come off of, before he came here, of feeding the 5,000. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on just in the context of the visit to Caesarea Philippi. But what's interesting about Luke chapter 9 is that it tells us that about 8 days after Jesus makes the big statement, he takes a couple of his disciples to the high mountain. Mm. And we know the transfiguration story. He ascends. And again, this is like the final, you know, warning for the demonic realm. What's interesting about that when you figure in the Parentalia is that, again, the translation here is about 8 days. Well, from the time when Jesus makes these statements to the ending of the Parentalia, you're working with that within that window. Mm. And what's interesting, I think it's the last day of the Parentalia that Jesus does this, that the transfiguration actually takes place, because the last day of the Parentalia is divided up into these little daily festivals. And the last one was called the Feralia. And if people want to read more about this, again, it's public record. I would suggest reading Ovid's Fast Eye, because he talks a little bit about, you know, go to the, and it's in translation. You don't have to know Latin to do it. I would suggest Sir James Fraser's translation. It's widely available. So if people want to know more details about this, they can certainly look for it themselves. But the last is this really weird festival, the mini festival, the Feralia.
Yeah.
And this is when the most malevolent and wicked of these underworld spirits was to be placated by the worshipers. Now, isn't it interesting that if I'm right, while that's happening in Caesarea Philippi, Jesus is going up at the same time on Mount Hermon and the Transfiguration is taking place. So that's why I think that there's this, you know, we've at least got a more exacting window to work with here. And these two festivals, first of all, the Lupercalia, and also in the wider temporal scope, the Parentalia, add to the meaning of the visit. But I also think that on this side of history, it gives us some insight into when all of this has happened.
It's kind of like with any festival, you sort of have the Ferelia is like the closing ceremonies of this whole festival. And you're saying that Jesus goes on the mountain on that day specifically and transfigures and sort of shines above all of it on top of the mountain.
Right, right. Again, it's the same kind of logic of Jesus establishing the church and the Petrine Confession, all that happening on the Lupercalia, and the big climax is at the end of it.
And it says that Roman citizens were instructed to bring offerings to the tombs of their dead ancestors on this day. Do you think the ancients, they're obsessed with the afterlife, they're obsessed with the death of their ancestors, they're building all kinds of monuments all over the world doing the same things? I mean, it makes me think, and I'm not smart enough to dissect all this, but if Jesus is crushing death, defeating death, and yet you have all these civilizations obsessed with death, they're afraid to die, they're trying to honor their dead, and Jesus is going to these festivals of the dead, and he's, you know what I mean, like what he represents is life. And what's interesting to me too is that people believed in the afterlife. People had a framework for the afterlife. People knew exactly where their ancestors went, and they had festivals to honor them and to pour out offerings to them. They didn't have a belief problem. They didn't live in the age of unbelief. And Christians today, you ask a Christian, like, where did people go before Christ? Where did they go? And most of us have no idea. We have no clue. And we're interpreting all these stories with little or no knowledge of these festivals and what they believed. And most modern day Christians, if you ask them about the afterlife, they would say that the ancients were superstitious. That's how they would say, which is terribly wrong. They weren't superstitious. They knew. They had knowledge. They just believed that their gods were superior. And it's really frustrating because it seems like this is like a huge party. This is a massive festival. And Jesus rolls into the town in the middle of it. And all the context is lost on us because we just can't visualize it. But think closing ceremonies like in the Olympics. You have this massive event to honor the dead. There's in modern day terms, there'd be fireworks and there'd be this big production. And Jesus is, you know, climbing the mountain with a few of his disciples, ready to do his own miraculous event, and shines, right? And I just think that's all lost on us because Christians today, like I said, you know, most people actually, Christians and non-Christians, think that the ancients are just superstitious. This is just all in their head, but they have this knowledge. They know more about the afterlife than we do today. That's wild. And so it seems like everyone was obsessed and seeking after this, and Jesus is going to these places, and he is the counter story to the...
He is, yeah. That's why all of this, you know, these other traditions, you know, by the definition would have been antichrist. They were false eternities. They were counterfeit eternities that were being offered, and the toll that people, you know, had to pay in order to ensure, you know, not even the happiest of eternities often involved, you know, sacrificial victims, whether they were animal or human. So here you've got this, you know, vampiric element, if you will, to all of these ancient traditions that demanded such a heavy blood toll. And here is Jesus freely offering his blood for the real eternity, not some counterfeit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just interesting. I
like it too, Nate, because it feels like, you know, this is the crescendo of Parentalia, which is this veneration as Judd is talking about of the dead, the Rephaim. Ultimately it is worship of those that left their estate and rebelled against God. Right. If you go all the way up the ladder, And it really is Jesus dunking on him, being like, okay, at this point, the crescendo of your festival, let me just reveal that I am the fulfillment of the law and prophets. And let me just get into a cloud, and my father will say, this is my son whom I've chosen, listen to him. And I love that. I love that. It's like, you're not going to get your moment, right? Because your time is up. And it's such good context because, you know, within that purview, it is absolutely Jesus revealing himself saying, no, this day isn't yours. It's mine.
It's important to contextualize that as a revelation, not only to the good, but also the evil here, because I think we get a pretty clear picture from scripture that Satan and the demons had some idea of what was coming down the pike, but they didn't have an exact idea. That's why so many of the giant tribes cluster in the Levant, you know, they're sort of tripping over each other's big feet because they don't know exactly where the Messiah is coming back, but they got this general idea. And so they never have the specificity of the heavenly perspective, but they can see farther down the road. They can prognosticate, you know, more than humans can. But it was still an imperfect view down the pike. And all of this was kind of a revelation. You could say that it starts, you know, the big surprise starts with the birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, whoa, what is going on here? And that revelation, you know, in a lot of ways comes to its apex with the transfiguration. We know what happens after that. He goes down to Jerusalem to die.
Mm-hmm. And regardless, I think what's so dismissing a lot of times is that people view pagans and pagan religions and pagan festivals like they didn't have a reason or rhyme or there was no power or reason. You know what I mean? Like they're very dismissive of them. Mm-hmm. And yet you see these festivals all over. Is this connected to, I think it's Lemuria, didn't the Romans have like a 3-day festival, exercise their own dead from their houses?
That's right. Yes, they did. And in fact, the Feralia is also part of the rites that were observed during that last part of the Parentalia were exorcism rites. Hmm. They were to drive back and out these malevolent underworld spirits.
So when do you think Jesus was crucified? Because what if he's crucified on one of those holidays?
Well, that's a whole other episode. Can of worms.
It's a whole other episode.
That was that. But what I'm saying is carrot, right?
And that's why I'm saying, I mean, what we usually celebrate Resurrection Sunday. It's in the spring, right? So if all of this is happening in mid to, you know, the last day of all of this happening is the 21st, 22nd, six weeks down the line, You're in Easter territory, right? I mean, in terms of timing.
It's interesting because the Lemuria festival, it says that all the temples were closed for 3 days, and you couldn't get married.
Mm-hmm.
And they're what? They're trying to exorcise ghosts and restless dead from their homes. And I don't know. I'm just like peering into these ancient festivals and how much they were paranoid and knew about the dead and the underworld and the afterlife. And we talk a lot about it on our show, but we kind of go back and we look at some of this, the clues that are there, but no Christians reading the Bible are understanding like how paranoid these people were about family lines and their history and their ancestors. Like we today, like, I mean, most people don't go to the graves or see anything, or we don't really have any thoughts or feelings about these things. We kind of go, you know, go to the graveyard every once in a while, put some flowers down. Yeah.
Not in the West. Yeah.
Not in the West. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. So what is the lesson there? Don't get married during an exorcism. It's a good one. It's one to take home. Write that one down, Jed. That's your next book.
That's sort of like never get involved in a land war in Asia.
Right. Only slightly less famous. My man. Well played. Just never get involved with a Sicilian when death is on the line.
That's right. Yeah.
Wrong movie.
Great movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I know. I couldn't think of a Back to the Future line that would go with that.
Time traveling is just too dangerous. Better that you devote yourself to the study of the great mystery of the universe. Women.
Wow, it's amazing to me. Well, it's not amazing that Doc Brown thought that was like the ultimate,
you know,
most
mystery.
Challenging. the ultimate most challenging scientific mystery, and it very well may be.
So then wrap it up with us, Judd. What does the transfiguration really mean to you? That it's at the end. It's at the end of this festival. Like, what does Judd's brain tell him?
It is the last in this passage. It is, and really, in a lot of ways, in Jesus' ministry, it's really like the next to the last display of God's jurisprudence against the demonic realm. But the other side of that is that it also puts in glorified form the last piece, or the second to last piece of the puzzle in place for Jesus to carry out his mission on earth, which was again to provide redemption for humanity. Again, I've read these passages over and over. This year, it just really kind of jumped out. But what it illustrates ultimately is that it is the perfect timing and the perfect intent of our Heavenly Father, and that manifested throughout the entirety of Jesus's ministry on earth.
Why do you think at the end of all of this craziness with the transfiguration and the disciples stepping to the cloud and hearing the audible voice of God and seeing Elijah and Moses and asking to build, should we build shelters for you guys? It says they kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone. Why do you think that is? Like, if you were to have this happen, I know this happens throughout Jesus' ministry. He tells people, don't tell anybody this. Don't tell anybody I healed you. Don't tell anybody about what I did. And I think maybe there's a whole episode in some why Jesus wants these things. It's probably timing, and we're talking about timing in this episode. But
yeah.
I always find that fascinating that you have something unbelievably miraculous happen to you, and you got to keep the biggest secret of your life and not tell anyone.
Up to the point to when Jesus was resurrected. Again, it's all part of sacred timing.
Correct.
And the more I think about Jesus's ministry in the context of sacred geography and sacred time, it's like the signs in the heavens. It's like one side of that is, we could say, is it glorifies, the movement of the stars and the planets and their arrangement. It glorifies God. It is in a lot of ways, it is a kind of cosmic clock, but it can also be, manipulated for selfish and evil ends in a like manner, not the latter, not the using it for selfish ends, but for the glorification of God. There is a timing and a pacing to what he does. I mean, to sort of expand this and draw it back a little bit, look at the prophetic timing that we read, throughout, especially the Old Testament, but, also the New Testament, as we're starting to see, and have been seeing unfolding around us for some time. The locations are important, and the times are important, because again, they inform the nuance of context, and therein lies a more complete theology. If it's the more bereft of context your reading of scripture is, the less grounded theology.
Wow. Timing and location, right? Some of the most important things there are.
It's interesting, Judd. I'm reading about the Feralia, this last day where the transfiguration takes place. And the Roman citizens were told to bring bread-soaked wine to offer the dead.
Yep.
Now there's...
That's right.
There's an imagery. So Jesus is right. Goes in as a last meal. Mm-hmm. And he does that.
Yeah.
There's so much wrapped up in here.
Dude, yeah. Pregnant.
It's the same. It's the same sort of imagery that's at play in the pagans, except they're offering to their underworld spirits and gods who were taking flesh and blood. Jesus is offering his flesh and blood.
Yeah. And think about this too, right? And I love that it just made me think that this is it. Is do this in remembrance of me. And it's not because Jesus is dead; it's because he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how we flipped this. It's not a veneration of the dead; it is a worship of He who is alive and on the throne.
Mm. Amen. That's it.
I love it, man. Joe, this has been great. It's sacred timing, sacred geology. I love the way you think about these things, and it's so great to have you back and to be talking about timing and locations when it comes to, you know, to cosmic warfare and cosmic geography in its relation to physical geography and the ministry of Jesus, and then of course spiritual warfare that comes alongside that. It is intertwined inevitably with what Jesus is doing, and it's awesome. So thank you for that. That is there's no one better to espouse upon the mysteries of Peneus than Dr. Jed Burton. And grateful to have you back in the Blurryverse doing the thing, doing your thing.
And you got a song and a dance.
Dude. On this. We started out with a song. The crescendo just kept building. It was like, you think that's the high point? It's not the high point. It is it's working towards the transfiguration. And well, Judd, we love you, man, and we're so great to sit down and have another conversation with you. Yeah, let everybody know what you're up to. I know that you have some things kind of on the horizon here. We talked about and it may be things you're not ready to announce yet, but if you'd like to talk about what's coming down the pike for you, that would be fantastic, because I think people in our audience, they love you. They've been waiting for your dulcet tones to return, and they'd love to hear about what's happening in the in Burton and beyond. Hey.
Mm-hmm. Well, the new website is burtonbeyond.net. So if people want to go, they can look at the new and improved stuff. And I've got new coursework that I'm planning to. My initial plan had been to deploy it this month, but it's probably going to be towards the end of the month before I can deploy the new stuff. Doug Van Dorn and I are working on a book right now on the Serpent Mound of Bashan, which is in the region of the Upper Galilee, like we're talking about. You know, we're talking about Peneus today. So there's going to be some overlap there with some of tonight's material. But this fall, we hope to start new filming for French Pop 321.
Let's go.
Which, of course, is part of our friend Dr. Michael Heiser's legacy. Dr. Aaron Judkins and I will be the new host. Mike had asked us to do that.
So many doctors. It's not a medical show, though, right?
It's not a medical show.
It's a lot of doctors.
You can't keep a good scientist down.
That's right.
That's right. That's right. So those are some of the things that are cooking, that are in the pipe.
Love that. We'll do. Love it, Judd. So good to see you, Judd. Yeah, we love you. We're gonna have some things to do down the road. So we're excited to see you, man, and excited that you're on the mend. That's great. And you know, if you're listening, Judd could use your prayers as well as he heals up. And so we're asking you guys to join us in lifting up Judd and his health as he continues to rehab. And yeah, man, we're just, it's good to see your face, man. You look good, you know.
That's great. Great to be back.
Yeah. And if you have any, if you want to write up a little bit about some of the stuff in this episode, maybe post in the members group, some of these festivals, maybe a little detail, like, if you want to throw it in the back end, I think our listeners would love it. We got a good group of members now. I think that'd be cool, Judd. Like, Judd's in our members group. So if you haven't become a member of the show too, Judd's always in there chatting away.
He's lurking. The
ladies are chasing him down.
He's lurking in there.
He's
lurking, making sure he's correcting all the hermeneutics in there that need to be corrected.
That's right. That's right. All done in love.
Yes.
But it'd be cool. It'd be cool to get some more info on these festivals and kind of give some context to what's going on. And
I feel like this whole topic is pregnant with so much meaning.
Oh yeah, they were just slapping those thighs, you know. So.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, get out the old whip. This just sounds a little weird, but you know, it's some people's thing.
This show took such a turn. Such a weird.
I did it at the end. This may get edited out. Do you gotta turn this off for it's. Before this digresses completely.
This is incriminating evidence. This is all of the NSA.
This is all like the director's cut.
This is B-roll at the end.
You don't get this until. Anyway, we love you, bro.
Good to see you, man.
Love you too, guys. All right, take it easy. I appreciate it.
It's so good to see you, bro. Yeah. Later, y'all.
Later, Jed.
Peace out.